pase, pierna derecha, directo al arco, golazo, golazo.
The world of football with a soccer perspective. This is Soccer Today with Dwayne Mullins and Kevin Larame, live on the Sports Podcasting Network.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Soccer Today for Friday, March 15th, 2019. I'm Kevin Larame. Dwayne Mullins is online as well, joining us this morning live from Top Drawer Soccer to talk development and professional pathway for players, for development, for academies. Travis Clark of Top Drawer Soccer. How you doing today, Travis?
I'm doing all right. No snow this time.
No snow, and we're not going to talk about drafts. Deal?
Deal.
All right. Yesterday, the United Soccer League, USL, as it's more commonly known, unveiled plans for what they call their vision of the league's academy system moving forward, the USL Academy Cup, which will start this year, which will ultimately lead to a USL Academy League. This would just be another addition to their already expanding landscape of American soccer. Can you just sort of outline what exactly this is, and then maybe we'll jump into whether it's a good thing or not in a minute?
Yeah, so from what I understand, I don't even know what it might end up being when all is said and done, just because I feel like, you know, they put down a lot of ideas on paper, but in practice you need to see these academy teams come together, see what exactly the competition looks like, see how these academies are set up. You know, are these USL local teams, speaking specifically in the United States, of course, are these specific USL teams going out and merging with clubs that exist in their markets and then, you know, creating something that way? Is it starting from scratch, looking to bring in the best players you can, then pay, you know, offering spots free of charge for all the players to come to? Like, there's so many variables and questions still. Obviously, you know, they spelled out as U13, I believe, just U13 and U17 age groups. So teams are being asked to start small. So it'll be a similar competition, from what I gather, to the Generation Adidas Cup in Major League Soccer. So you have, you know, for those unfamiliar, they are, you know, 2 weekends out of the club season where MLS teams gather together to play like group stage competitions. They culminate with a sort of a week-long Generation Adidas Cup final in Texas, and that'll actually take place next month around this time. So the idea, I feel like the USL is putting together something very similar, and that's probably a good place to start with understanding what it may look like. So, you know, there's talk of trying to implement their own league, but from having covered this in the U.S. extensively, I'm still like, okay, let's see what happens, what comes together, before being like, okay, this is going to be good, bad, or I'm kind of indifferent to it.
Fair enough. Yeah, it gets very confusing because, of course, it's very, very large. And in that way, a lot of, when you look at academies, when you look at youth play, you almost have to break things down regionally. Correct, Travis? I would have to say. Expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, the issue with development here in this country is always going to be about the size and the expense and the time that players have to go in order to compete in these events. So, again, like, you know, there's talk of an MLS breakaway league within the academy system that we hear. I feel I've heard it almost 7 years of doing this. And again, I'm in a position where I will believe it when I see it, because the expense to do that is so significant to these clubs. And yes, I think the Seattles of the world are willing to. Toronto does a good job with its academy. But, you know, on the flip side, like, I can't see the New England Revolution being all in, or, you know, DC United still charging for its academy. Here where I am, I just don't know that I buy that. And again, it's something that I will only believe when I see. As I know that's a waffling non-answer, but there's such complexities and nuances to this these ideas that it's a you're almost fighting against the grain still to an extent in the United States, because for a lot of the players that have entered the system. You know, let's say you're a 15-year-old right now, and 10 years ago you started playing soccer, and the elite circuit was still more about college than it is about becoming a professional. So, and I know there are market differences between Canada and the United States in that regard, but at the same time, like, you're still swimming upstream to an extent, because, you know, players aren't necessarily going to want okay, I'm gonna sign a USL contract here in the US. Like, it's starting to happen more and more, so maybe it's becoming more viable. But we're still a pretty long way, I think, from it becoming more commonplace, in my opinion.
When we look at the USL Academy and the plan on paper, and what it could look like in a few years from now, with maybe what you're saying, an amalgamation of many different academies, or maybe even different sources, who knows? Could be MLS academies, like you mentioned, and you have a kind of like a breakaway league or a standaway league, like you were talking about, which reminds me of England. And I know it's easy to make the England comparison with the USL Championship, League One, League Two, but for me, it reminds me of example team of U23s or U20s or U17s from Europe that plays against lower league clubs that has an academy that are in the same type of development pathway, which is different at the top level, but in the smaller levels, they are equivalent. Is there a possibility that we see this, Travis, where maybe we have USL academies, maybe we have MLS academies in the future, who knows? Canadian Premier League academies in the future, all in the same type of kind of like a league or at least a tournament type of format. Do you envision this?
I think that's got to be the direction you want to steer this ship in, right? Because if you're talking about Major League Soccer and USL operating their own separate leagues where your main purpose and goal is to produce professional players for your first team, then the more teams that you can play against, you know, that's part of the knock that if you talk to an MLS Academy director or whatever, and you kind of look at it between that difference between that and a non-MLS academy within the development academy, a lot of what you hear is our purpose is a little bit different than what they're trying to do. So if you are then in theory throwing all of these same teams into a pot, you know, and even the Canadian Premier League teams, let's envision that as being part of it. That would be an asset to North American development landscape. But again, it's more like, how practical is that? How sustainable is it without any kind of mechanisms for training compensation and solidarity payments? And I think it's important to point that out. So let's say something like that is implemented. Are these MLS teams then going to be compensating clubs that are pay to play or not MLS Academy? Are they going to compensate? Let's say a U16, U17 player is a rising star but hasn't switched over for whatever reason. Are they going to then be compensating players for those? Then we're talking about a lot more money, and I just don't see how there's the injection of, you know, finances to kind of make that a viable system, as much as I would like to see it happen. Let me be clear about that, too.
You mentioned the S word, the solidarity payment word.
The S word.
The S word. And, you know, it's fascinating, the whole situation with Yedlin, which is one of the recent cases. Dwayne and I talked about this a lot, where we have seen, like literally, we have seen a picture of the check that trickled down from Canadian players being signed abroad and in their lower academies here in Canada. What can you tell us about maybe the Yedlin and Bradley specific cases, but in general, for the Lehmans out there, can you quickly try to explain to us what a solidarity payment is and how it affects the Yedlin situation?
So yeah, those I'll try to keep it straight. The Bradley case is a club in Chicago that says it should get a part of the check from the transfer fee that Toronto FC paid to Roma when he moved back to MLS. And you know, the idea of solidarity payments being that when a player is transferred, then a small portion of that player's transfer fee should go back to a club that helped facilitate his development. And it's a little bit confusing to me, so apologies if I'm getting any details wrong, but I think that's kind of the general idea. So there are a few clubs here in the U.S. that specifically, I believe it's Crossfire Premier in the Seattle area, which had DeAndre Yedlin on its books before he joined the Sounders Academy. He's trying to get a cut of his transfer fee. I think it was the Clint Dempsey. I don't know why Omar Gonzalez is coming to my mind. I don't think anyone has ever paid a transfer fee for him, but I know Clint Dempsey was part of this, even though he's now retired. And the fee that I think it's also was it the fee that Seattle paid to get him from Tottenham. I don't know. Anyway, so basically, these clubs are out there trying to get a small chunk. There was actually, I think it was the Dempsey and Bradley cases were, you know, FIFA said no, we're not going to do this. And then if you want to learn about why we're not going to do this, you have to pay us $10,000, which is like, that's such a FIFA move, right? Like, you have to pay to get an explanation for why your case is being denied. So the idea then being like, if a U.S. player is moving abroad, then should these clubs that they've played for in the past get a little bit of a slice of it? Like, and we're talking pretty small, but pretty small on the, like, the mega transfer scale, but also, you know, meaningful money for clubs that can try to offer scholarships or cut costs for some of their players currently on the roster.
And Travis, just, yeah, the attorney involved in the case, the two cases that were dismissed this week, which were the Dempsey and the Bradley case claims against the clubs, Lance Reich, I guess is the gentleman's name, said that the reason that they were disputed in their mind, although they don't know, as you say, for sure, but is because that the player passport wasn't upkept by USSF. So basically the USSF didn't do the correct paperwork, which allowed the, anyway, it's a complete mess when you really think about it that way. Let's get down the road, though. Let's put all the weeds aside here for a second and just get to the juxt of this thing. Should pay-to-pay or pay-to-play academies get solidarity fees? Because I'm asking about pay-to-play because I think that we all understand that the non-pay-to-play probably should because the rest of the world does. But let's talk about the pay-to-play. Do they deserve something too?
Yeah, you know, I kind of go back and forth in that. And when – so back I think it's easy to say – it's easy to see the argument from both sides, but in some ways, like, shouldn't this is kind of a weird answer to it, but it's like, shouldn't you, like, give the player his money back or give the money to his family? Like, if you go to the club could then pass it along. I think the PA Classics coach, that the Christian Pulisic move from Dortmund to Chelsea or kind of brought this back to light, as I feel like any major or relatively major transfer will be linked to this idea from now on, if it's especially a non-MLS academy team sending a player somewhere. But you know, the coach was like, well, I think Christian made himself more of the player that he is than we did, which is kind of a really stupid and absurd answer to, in my opinion, where you're basically saying, oh, we as a club did not help our player reach this, and so, like, he kind of like dumped on his own organization in some ways by saying that. But the short answer to it, I feel like, is it's complicated because you never know exactly how and what was paid and when, but it does seem kind of counterintuitive for a player that had to pay whatever sum to compete on a team. That club should then turn around and get money for this player's career progression made a few years later. So I'm waffling, but I'm going to go ahead and say no, I don't think they should, because of sort of what I laid out there. I think, you know, I think in the case of Yedlin, he was on a little bit of scholarship, so maybe it's a little bit nuanced there, but it's just kind of a difficult road to navigate through, I think.
All right, fair enough. Let's be more general in the next couple questions. Obviously, we talk about development all the time. We lament about how it's bad, how it's terrible. Let's go positive for a second, Travis. Can you tell me, in your mind, you've been doing this for 7 years, one thing that the U.S., and Kevin and I are going to talk about Canada after the break, that the U.S. is doing well, is doing better now than they were 7 years ago?
Well, they, I think, are offering much more accessibility to playing time for younger players, and that obviously has a lot to do with USL teams. And it goes beyond really just having the USL team and like competitive minutes for player to get. But, you know, if you're a promising 14 and 15 year old in an academy and there's a professional team, whether it's, you know, the MLS run USL team, the MLS team, whatever you have, then that player can then test himself against grown full professionals. And I feel like that those opportunities were much fewer and far between, as you know, even like 3-4 years ago. Right. So there's definitely a downside to it where, in some case, you wonder about, are some organizations like Seattle Sounders have done a very good job at kind of just tying down all of their 15, 16, and 17-year-olds. But on the flip side of that, it's like, you know, are you denying these kids chances to, like, are they, you know, the education to piece is always bandied about as like, oh, well, you're turning down a scholarship. And I do think that each player can make his informed decision, but you know, hopefully those decisions are taken very seriously. Because I know in Canada it's a little bit different, where players can, you know, sign early, but then also go to school a lot cheaper, and in some cases even play in the Canadian system. So, you know, while like college soccer is not the be-all end-all, and if you want to reach your maximum as a potential pro, you probably don't want to play college soccer in at this point in the development of North America and the United States. But, you know, these kind of opportunities, and, you know, when a player is 16, 17 and signed as a homegrown here, now they don't just like sit around and train and they get no competitive action for a while. They can stay in their academy, or, you know, like I said, they can be bumped up into whatever level they have shown the ability to cope with. So that certainly helped look at someone like Tyler Adams, for example, where he signs with Red Bulls 2 first and then gets promoted to Red Bulls, and then in one way gets promoted again to Red Bulls in Germany. So like the progression there is a little bit different than most organizations, but it's sort of, you know, that's something that before they made a concerted effort towards development wasn't really those kind of options were not there for the best players in the United States.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Tyler Adam pathway, because I think he represents maybe the ideal pathway moving forward for American players in the system that we have now, especially with all the USLs that we have now. There seemed to be an actual pathway to becoming a pro. Like it's clear. It's clear. You're okay. You're with your young municipality association soccer. You're playing good. You're being discovered at 13, 14, 15. You start to play for either an MLS academy, a USL academy, or just an academy per se. Then 16, 17, U18, U19, U20, you make the reserve team, USL team. Then you make the MLS team and you get sold. How important is it, Travis, in your mind? You've been following this before there was that pathway. How important is that pathway? And are we finally, when I say we, is the USL, MLS, in the United States Soccer Federation, with that pyramid that is existing now because of the effort of the USL, is it the right pathway? And is it time, finally, to have a clear-cut pathway to becoming a pro player?
Yeah, I mean, it could always be better, right? Like, you could always talk about having a more open system, right, where there are infinite more professional teams in the third, fourth, fifth divisions, where, you know, those teams all operate academies, which is much more like, you know, the setup you see in Europe, and that would offer just more coverage and more access and more touches to professional organizations. You know, obviously the soccer culture here is not what it is there. There's not the history behind it. There's the obvious desire of MLS owners to have I don't want to use the word cartel, but, you know, kind of a corner on the market to an extent,
like a monopoly,
without pissing off too many people who are listening. But, you know, that kind of is, they protect their market with the way the system is set up. And, you know, if you open it up to more of a sporting merit, obviously there's no perfect answer, but like that would create even potentially infinite more development pathways if it were done right. But there's also the downside to it, where you point out, would it be done right? How do you regulate it? And, you know, does then your development pathway just become more about the results piece than it is actual development of players? So I'm kind of leading us down kind of a wormhole, so I'll extract that. But the system that we do have in place now certainly is opening more doors. MLS teams are becoming aggressive about recruiting outside of markets, which will only help players that can seek that opportunity make the move. You know, it could always be better. There always should be more. You know, no kid in the U.S. or Canada should have to, maybe less so Canada, just there's, you know, smaller metropolitan areas and less, fewer cities in general, but kids shouldn't have to make, you know, 3 to 4 hours. Like, there's still some crazy stories about kids commuting to bigger cities to play for bigger clubs, and I feel like that's something that should be sought, that, you know, soccer development leaders should seek to eradicate, if that makes sense.
So no more Clint Dempsey driving through the Texas heat for 4 hours each way, or whatever the story was. Travis,
yeah, there's got to be a way to address that. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know, West Texas FC, whether that's, anyway. Let's talk about the women to end the conversation, because we haven't talked about the female pathway at all, because that's just the case often, because we just assume the NCAA is going to be that pathway. Is there any movement? Is there any possibility that we might see a more professionalization of the female pathway moving forward, or is the NCAA still going to be queen forever there?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to see it ever changing, right? You know, obviously there's a case in Canada recently where Jordan Huitema is signing professional with likely PSG, but you know, she's more of one-off, the Mallory Few types. I think until we need to see the NWSL have a bigger footprint within North America in order for it to really show what it can do. I mean, you know, it's at the end of the day, the goal on the women's side, the sort of amount of money you can make is certainly maximized by going to college and, you know, leveraging your playing career into a college scholarship as opposed to a pro career. I do think that, you know, one of the reasons why the U.S. and, you know, maybe, of course, they'll probably go ahead and win the World Cup after I say this, but one of the main reasons the U.S. is kind of getting stuck behind is because of the NCAA. And, you know, it's a great opportunity, and I'm not trying to smash and bag on college soccer, but there's certainly limitations to it in terms of, you know, your time allowed to training and the competition that some programs get. I think that the top programs still offer a pretty good, you know, I think an interesting litmus test. You look at Jessie Fleming, who's playing at UCLA still, and she appears to be ahead of Mallory Pugh in terms of just the kind of player and the impact that she can make for whether it's national team or, you know, in Jessie's case, obviously UCLA, and Pugh struggled to stay healthy at the Washington Spirit. So I believe they entered the same recruiting class, and I think their careers will be an interesting sort of case study of this, where I don't think the stability, especially here, is there for players to bypass college. But, you know, I don't know if you guys saw this or covered this or talked about it. There was a 13-year-old that signed a professional with an agency and is training now with the Portland Thorns. But even in her case, I'm not really sure what she's going to do for the next few years, and, you know, how much of her, you know, quote unquote turning professional was, you know, she's a talented player. But she's born in 2005 and has like 80,000 Instagram followers. And how much is it more about
stunt?
Yeah, if you're Nike cultivating an image, and like, she's kind of like a soccer influencer more than she is a professional soccer player at this point. Not to be negative, but that's one way you could look at it, because there are players sort of in her age group, in her age range, that are sort of at her level, and they aren't getting offers from Nike for six figures. You know, what's the difference there, right? Like, you just kind of look at it and say, okay, you know, if I'm a company like Nike, then I can leverage this player's account versus, okay, well, this player wants to go to college and has like 1,000 followers, so what's the point there? So, look, I'm not taking away from her ability, and we don't need to talk too much into it, but it's an interesting, another interesting, you know, piece of data to track, to follow as kind of her path goes and what her career ends up being.
Yeah, it's it reminds me of publicity stunts when you talk about that that example, for sure. When you, as a company, it's a lot more fun for the company when you get into a partnership with someone that brings you something. Even if it's a 13-year-old soccer player, if it brings you 80,000 views easily of your product, well, you achieve something that just a player who's just solely focused on becoming a good player will not have, because they're not talking about brands. They're just talking about, I need to practice soccer.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect example. Like, it's an easy example to spot, even if people would take umbrage to it. Like, you know, yes, she's a really good player. Yes, she's playing up. She's played against boys' teams. There is clearly a player of ability here. But on the other side, what's the piece here that a big, you know, multinational conglomerate is really looking at, and really, you know, that's the part of it that seems to sell more than the soccer piece at this point in her career. And, you know, she could go on to be a U.S. women's national team star, and Nike's, you know, investment would be rewarded, but, you know, at the same time, like, does that, you know, maybe maybe what she's getting paid is worth more than a college scholarship too, and she's probably well off enough that skipping college doesn't matter. So I'll be interested to see if there are any more, like, are they follow the leader types? I'm sure the U.S. Soccer Federation on the women's side would love to see more players turning pro early, maybe not in, like, sort of this case, but like 16, 17, 18 year olds. But, you know, at the same time, it's certainly something to watch, especially with the World Cup this year, with the U.S. women's national teams, youth teams struggling to be any good, really, if we're being honest.
Travis Clark of Top Drawer Soccer, thank you very much for your time today. It was fun to talk to you outside of just the draft and outside of just the College Cup. Your two annual, for sure, appearance or caps. Your two caps of the year. So your third cap this year.
Nice. It's good to talk about something else, and I'm happy to come on at any point and ramble on about it.
You can follow Travis on Twitter at Travis M. Clark, and you can follow Travis's work at Top Drawer Soccer. We'll be right back after this short break with the weekend preview, and we'll talk about the draws in the Champions League and Europa League.
You are listening to Soccer Today. Follow us on Twitter at Soccer Today SPN and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/sportspodcastingnetwork. You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.
And we're back on Soccer Today. You can follow Dwayne at 24th Minute and myself at Kev Laramie. And we're back. Dwayne, before we move on and talk about the weekend, there's another development component of our development day. In Alberta, there's two U20 teams that have been announced will be part of the Alberta Provincial League, or the beginning of one. And that's interesting that the U20 team now included in local soccer.
Yeah. To be clear, it's the FC Edmonton and the Cavalry FC, the Calgary's Canadian Premier League team. They're essentially their academies, their U20 teams will be involved in the top league, the top development league in Alberta. This, a lot of people in the Canadian soccer circle are hopeful, will be the start of a Western Canadian league to rival the PLSQ and Big One Ontario in terms of that D3 level in this country, which I think is key. And I think if you look at the Canadian Premier League's decision to purchase League One Ontario outright, a big part of their strategic planning moving forward in terms of getting, you know, into smaller markets and I think even eventually getting a D2 level established in Canada. I think that's part of their planning there, but it's also a big part of their development sort of perspective. They view League One Ontario, I know this for a fact, they view League One Ontario much in the same way that the NHL would view the CHL, the Canadian Hockey League, in terms of a key place for young players to play and be seen that is outside of the college system. So this is a step sort of in that way to include another part of the country in that, which is going to be vital if the Canadian Premier League is to be, you know, coast to coast to coast, truly. I don't know if we'll ever see that third coast included. That would be something. Yellowknife FC, I'd be all over that. But
hey, talk about a home field advantage and talk about a heck of a travel, a heck of an away day.
Yeah,
let's take an away week because it takes us a week to get there.
Fair enough. You can't go in the winter. Talking, they can't have winter schedule up there. They don't even have the roads.
They can barely have the summer schedule. They can barely play in like April and May. Anyways.
There you go. Quickly, the last thought on that. Those that remember Ben Knight from the It's Called Football days, Ben Knight used to write on Canadian Soccer News all the time about the political nightmare that was Alberta soccer. You could probably go back into the archives of Canadian Soccer League or Soccer News and find those articles where he would get into the minutiae of like the absolute pathetic, we'll just use that term outright, infighting between the adults involved in youth sport. It was ugly. About 10 years ago, this was a topic that was commonly talked about, and one of the big divides that was happening back then, and this is the reason why the Calgary, you know, Cavalry FC is not called the Foothills, is because there is still, you know, political divides between the Foothills and other parts of the Alberta soccer scene there, right? So the fact that essentially the Foothills are now being included back into the fold in this league, in this team, in playing in the top development league is a positive development too, because that's another area that we didn't really touch on this, so sort of, I guess, but sort of that infighting that happens when you have so many people trying to grab a small piece of pie, you have a lot of people fighting over crumbs, right? And that's notoriously been the case up here, and this is sort of a bit of an indication that maybe that's beginning to change, and I think that if that is to change permanently in Canada, it's going to be driven by the Canadian Premier League. So good news there. Hope you enjoyed this development day. We like to deep dive into it about once a month. I think it's interesting to a lot of our listeners, and it's certainly interesting to me, Kevin. So with that note, unless you have anything further to say, we might as well dive into more of our daily bread and butter and start talking about the professional game again.
Yeah, well, we'll look at the MLS schedule in a second for this weekend. But before, UCL, UEFA Champions League, the draw was this morning. Same for Europa League. I'm going to show you the graphic of the Champions League game in a second if you're watching on video live. But before that, I'm going to do a little move here, a la Ronaldo and Simeone. Good thing you can't see me do the move right now. What that? Ronaldo, 3 goals. Juventus, moving on. Oh, that face of Antoine Griezmann when he realized that Ronaldo scored 3 goals on Wednesday. And that he thought, it's a 6th time. Oh, man. Fascinating results. And Barcelona beating Lyon to a pulp on Wednesday. Man City as well. It was a good round of games in the Champions League.
Yeah, it looks certainly a lot of storylines to talk about there. Spurs last week getting through as well. And we do now see of course, the quarterfinal lineups. And it is a pretty enticing quarterfinal matchup. You have your sort of sentimental underdogs at Ajax in there. You've got sort of the upcomers in Spurs. You've got the nouveau riche represented by Man City. Old school, I guess, in Porto, and kind of a different league because, well, the Dutch league's in there as well. And then, you know, Barcelona, Man United, that would have been one hell of a tie in 1999. I don't know how good of a tie it's going to be now, but we'll
and
see.
Liverpool Porto in like 1889. That's an amazing Champions Cup game right there.
Yeah, no, I think it was almost a near perfect draw for those people that want to see all the best of everything. Like I said, Juve, the favorite, I think, in most people's minds, playing the upstart, the sentimental favorite. You've got the two classic, huge fan base teams playing each other. Two teams in Man City and Spurs that will both be trying to get into, you know, new territory. For, well, City has been to the semis before, but not really in the form that they're in. And then you have, you know, Liverpool's a very popular team, and they got the easiest draw. So there you go. So I think it works out for a lot of people.
Tottenham Man City on April 9th. Liverpool Porto on April 9th as well. Both games at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific. Ajax Juventus on April 10th at 3 p.m. as well Eastern Time. And Man United Barcelona at 3 p.m. Fascinating matchups, and it's going to be a fun time. Let's quickly look at Europa League, because I don't have a graphic for that one. It's been too soon. But Napoli versus Arsenal, Villarreal versus Valencia, Benfica versus Eintracht Frankfurt, and we have as well Chelsea, who's going to host Slavia Praha as well. So two interesting matchups, and two, I would say, favorite. Arsenal-Chelsea may be the big favorite, but I wouldn't count Benfica out just yet. But it should be, maybe, an all-London final, depending on the draw.
Yeah, and Slava Prague is the last Eastern European team left in Europe. That is something to watch out there, something that is interesting to me, and that the Western Europe is completely lapping Eastern Europe now in terms of European competitions. You used to kind of see Ukrainian teams sticking around or the Russian Premier League teams sticking around. Slava Prague having a sort of a magical run going historically deep in the competition for them in there, and they came back from, they were down in stoppage time yesterday, not stoppage time, extra time yesterday, and scored 2 goals late to capture that, and to have one Eastern European flag still left in that. But then of course they draw Chelsea, who I think for a lot of people are the favorites left in this, although you know, the winner of that Villarreal-Valencia match is to me the favorite in this, because the Spanish teams are always the favorite until they lose. I watched Benfica yesterday. They kind of sputtered for a large portion of that against another Eastern European team, Dinamo something, forgive me. Don't have it in front of me, but nonetheless.
Kiev.
And
Dinamo of Kiev.
Yeah. Arsenal-Napoli is the best tie in this, but the Villarreal-Valencia, if you're a La Liga geek, you'll realize the quality that's in that. And typically, if you look at the Europa League over the past few years, it has been consistently those fifth to seventh, eighth, ninth place La Liga teams consistently win this, which is the biggest argument for La Liga being a better league than the team that, or the league that has six of the 16 remaining teams in Europe are, of course, coming from the league that we watch week in, week out in the Premier League. So that's your argument there. I think that it's hard to suggest that there's any league that even in the conversation for best in the world that isn't in England or in Spain right now. And I know a lot of people, a lot of hipsters out there like to bash on the Premier League, but how can you argue with four out of eight quarterfinals in the Champions League and two of the eight in the Europa League?
Well, I think, Dwayne, that the last 2 years have shown us that there's been a resurgence of England teams over the last year, and for sure over the last 2 years. Not England players. We're talking about England teams because a lot of foreigners are the stars of the Premier League. But Premier League is the biggest league in the world. Doesn't matter if they have the best team or not. It's the best league. The best team, that's in La Liga. But if you count the whole of the league, yeah, Premier League is the biggest playground in the whole world.
The argument I'll make real quickly on that Barstool argument right there is that the reason I think you see the top teams in the world, the Real Madrids, the Barcelonas, Bayern Munich prior to this last little bit, tend to not be in that league is because they consolidate their talent in much smaller doses in those leagues, right? Like Bayern Munich, you know that they are having an off year, but they're just going to gobble up all the talent in the Bundesliga this offseason, and away they go back to the races for another 3 or 4 years. That's just what they do. That doesn't happen in the Premier League. Even a club like City, which is richer than rich, can't just buy whoever they want within that league because those other clubs have history and they have huge fan bases and a lot of money themselves. Maybe not an unlimited, a bottomless pit of money, but they have enough money that they can have six teams in this case that are clearly all very good. Now, it drops off after that six, but tell me a league that doesn't. I think what sets the Liga apart and why I still would nod towards it being overall, I would take the 10th place La Liga team against the 10th place Premier League team is what I'm saying here. But that, I think, has to do more with the Spanish system, as you just alluded to, because they can draw cheap players from Spain that are very technically skilled and compete. If I have to look at the Europa League, almost fascinates me more at this stage than the Champions League for a lot of different reasons. But certainly, I think if you look at these matchups, that Arsenal-Napoli one's pretty mouth-watering because Arsenal, you don't know what you're going to get week in, week out. Napoli can be a fun team to watch. I think it's going to be a fun competition. And this is the point that we start to really pay attention to Europa. I watched the last round too, but this is when it gets interesting.
Let's look at the MLS matchups before we say goodbye for this week. Week number three. Apologies. Week number three. I got a cat in my mouth. Week number three in Major League Soccer. Seattle.
You from New England there?
I know. I was like, what's going on? Can I get some clam chowder? You had some chowder? Chicago, Seattle at 1 p.m. Columbus, FC Dallas at 2. Houston, Vancouver at 3 tomorrow. Red Bulls, San Jose, 3:30. Orlando, Montreal at 4. DC United, Real Salt Lake at 8. And LA Galaxy, Minnesota at 10:30 Eastern Time on Saturday. Dwayne, of the Saturday games, which one gets you excited?
The final one, I think, is the most interesting one of those Saturday games in terms of the resurgence. Minnesota, who has played two teams that we both think might be battling for the wooden spoon, but have nonetheless gotten two road wins, which has gotten a lot of people very, very excited in that city. And you don't blame them because they haven't had much to cheer for in the first 2 years. And the Galaxy, which are always interesting. Even when the Galaxy are bad, they're interesting to watch. So that one is the one. If you're going to watch one all week, I would throw that one on for sure. Outside of course your Canadian matchups, Orlando, Montreal. You would hope that the Impact might get something out of that one. But if they do, then I think they're off to the races. But the last one is interesting to me. I don't know, Houston, Vancouver. This is an interesting one too in terms of the Canadian side of these things. So Dynamo are going to be tired. So this is an opportunity, I think, for the Whitecaps to get something.
But it's Houston. It's temperature's not going to be easy, and it's a tough place to travel. And it's a long travel from Vancouver. We'll see. My interesting game for Saturday, Dwayne, is Orlando-Montreal. And here's my fantasy tip for the week as well. Make sure you join our fantasy league week 3. Nacho Piatti said he was feeling really good this week. Last week, he said he wasn't feeling too good, and we saw his performance. But week 1, he was feeling great and had an amazing performance. One goal and a lot of great movement on the field. But he says he's feeling even better now. And Orlando is the one team he scored the most goals against in Major League Soccer. I would captain Nacho Piatti in your fantasy this weekend. Even if it's on the road, trust me, he's feeling good. And it's Orlando. So Montreal should be able to get a few goals. And probably Nacho will get a few goals. So that's my tip for Saturday. Quickly look at the games on Sunday. 5 games on Sunday. A busy Sunday. NYCFC, LAFC, FC Cincinnati versus Portland, Atlanta United versus Philly, Toronto FC versus New England, and Colorado versus the sole survivor of Major League Soccer in the CONCACAF Champions League, Sporting Kansas City against Colorado on the road at 9 p.m. Sunday night. Which one gets your mojo going?
Obviously, I'll be at TFC's home opener, but in terms of, to put that aside for a second, and we're not going to talk about that in detail right now, because just listen to the other 4 days of Soccer Today if you want TFC talk. Portland getting that road. It's their first ever game at home. It's at that cruddy little stadium that they call home, which is a loud stadium, though, and they're almost on top of the players. You only get one first game ever in your history at home, and this is the first game for Cincinnati's history in MLS. I understand they played the level below before, so that's the one I'll be watching there. And then it is an interesting sort of measure as well to see, you know, what their point against Atlanta meant. Was that about Atlanta not playing well, or was that about Cincinnati rising their game out and figuring things out after a really poor first week? It tells you about Seattle, I think, too. Like, if Cincinnati goes in and plays competitively with Portland, then maybe we start to look at Seattle's 2-0 start and go, whoa, a little bit more. I think there's a lot to be learned from that matchup.
And, of course, my game that I'll keep an eye on is the one with Kansas City. 9 p.m. on Sunday versus Colorado. It'll tell us really where Colorado is this year, but I think it'll tell us just how high Sporting Kansas City's ceiling is this year. Of course, they were my pick, as always, for Support the Shield and MLS Cup. But after 2 weeks so far, they're looking at the cream of the crop of Major League Soccer, so we'll keep an eye, of course, on those games and come back Monday morning at 11 a.m. right here on Twitter and everywhere you get your podcasts to talk about the world of football with a soccer perspective, Major League Soccer style. You can follow Dwayne on social media at 24th Minute, myself at Kev Larame. And until next time, as always, make sure you do your fantasy team. Make sure you join our league if you haven't done so already. Thanks to all the Patreons. With your help, we're able to create specific shows like the Canadian Soccer Only specific show that happens every Thursday. Is the Two Solid Two Soccer Podcast. Patreon.com/sportspodcastnetwork. Thank you for your contributions. And until next week, as always, have a great soccer.
You can find the podcast version of all the shows we do on iTunes, Apple Podcast, Google Play Store, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, and anywhere you get your podcast.